Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Yasmine Seal is a translator, writer, poet, and artist. She has been working for many years on translating The Thousand and One Nights, and part of this work has just been published in the Annotated Arabian Nights from W.W. Norton, a huge and beautiful new edition with many new elements, illustrations, and essays. She is also working on translating a dream dictionary written by her own ancestor, Abdelghani al-Nabulsi, in 18th century Damascus. We are rerunning our conversation with Yasmine while we're on a break. We have many really wonderful older episodes that we recommend checking out over the holidays. Our year-end episode also lists 10 books that we found remarkable in one way or another. And if you've enjoyed listening to us, there are a few things you can do to support the show. You can subscribe on whatever podcast platform you use, rate us, share something about us on social media, and follow us on Twitter at Bulak Books, where we'll be sharing news soon about our upcoming season. Thank you, and wishing you all a happy new year.
If you dream of the sea, you will have something you were hoping for. If you dream of drinking the whole sea, your life will be long. If you dream of crossing the sea, you will gain what belongs to your enemy, just as the children of Israel crossed the sea and gained what belonged to Pharaoh. If you dream of urinating in the sea, you will persist in your mistakes. If you dream of seeing the sea from a distance, you will experience difficulty. If you dream of standing on the sea, you will receive from the authorities something you did not seek. If you dream of entering the sea, then leaving it, you will receive from the authorities a prize, and your cares will leave you. If you dream of swimming in the sea, then leaving it, and you are sick, God will cure you. And if you were distressed, God will give you relief. If you dream of passing from one side of the sea to the other, you will pass from anguish to safety. If you dream of drowning in the sea, you will be overcome with suffering, particularly if the water is opaque or if mud has swelled up from its depths. If you dream of swimming in the sea, you will find a way out of your situation. If you dream of swimming out of the sea, your situation will not end soon. If you dream of swimming out so far you are no longer seen, you will be lost. If you dream of dying in the sea, you will die a martyr. If you dream of drowning in the sea, rising and falling in the water, but not dying, you will be overcome by the state of the world. If you dream of diving for pearls in the sea, you are seeking money or something like it, and you will gain it in proportion to the pearls you find. If you dream of scooping water from the sea and filling a boat with it, you will have a boy who will live long. If you dream of taking water from the sea and drinking it, you will have money or knowledge in proportion to the water you drink, and if the water is dark, you will be afraid. If you dream of washing in the sea and you are afraid, you will be delivered from fear, and if you are in prison, you will be released. The sea may signify hell. If you dream of someone in the sea and that person is dead, they are in hell, and if that person is sick, they will get worse, and if you see them drown, their sickness will kill them. Some say that walking on water signifies something hidden becoming manifest. Some say it signifies danger. Dreaming of the sea may signify the end of life and contact with the unseen world. The sea may signify travel or war. Fresh water is faith, salt water, unbelief. The sea may signify rain. It may signify there is no God but God. It may signify anxiety or relief from anxiety. It may signify the father and mother, or a man and a woman with bad morals, or people with schemes. It may signify a prison for animals, or a craft without limits, or a city without walls. It may signify leaving a community. If you dream of the sea rising and rain was needed, it will rain.
Now that was Yasmin Seal reading for us from the dream manual of Abd al-Ghani al-Nabulsi, who lived in Damascus from 1641 to 1731. And this is the Bulaq podcast coming to you from Istanbul this time, and also, as usual, from Amman, Jordan with Ursula Lindsay. Hello, Ursula.
Hello.
And myself in Rabat, Morocco. So this is episode 61, and our guest today is Yasmin Seal. Thank you so very much for being here, Yasmin.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
And for those of you who don't know Yasmin yet, and you should, she was born into a literary family, the grandniece of Nizar Qabani, the widely beloved Syrian poet, and also, apparently, a descendant of the aforementioned Abd al-Ghani al-Nabulsi, who lived in Damascus, a scholar, a critic, and author of this beautiful book on dreams. Although she was French educated, she went to Oxford to study Arabic and was working on her PhD when the 1001 Nights scholar Paulo Horta came to London looking for someone who could translate both from French and Arabic. And somehow this led her to her first translated book, Aladdin, which came out from W.W. Norton in 2018. A fresh translation of the text from Antoine Galland. She is a widely admired poet and translator of poetry. She has crafted a beautiful and critically important translation of Badr Shekar Sayeb's Rain Song, which was published in 2018, as well as many other poetic translations. She's also a visual artist, which we can talk about, and is currently at work on a fresh translation of 1001 Nights.
I'll just add here, Yasmin, we are very excited to have you on, and we've been looking forward to this episode basically since the beginning of the fall, since you first agreed to talk with us. So it's really a pleasure to be talking with you today.
Thank you both so much, and thank you, Marcia, for that dream biography.
Yeah, well, I toned it down, so.
Yeah, I'm sure there's Marcia would have liked to say many more lovely and all true things about you and your work. But I'm going to pick up, Marcia just mentioned that you are working on a new translation of the 1001 Nights, which strikes me as a wonderful and daunting thing to be doing, to be wading into this ocean of stories. And so maybe we could start there. In a way, I think everyone has some familiarity with the Nights because they have sort of spread themselves into so many parts of our culture. And at the same time, sometimes we know them less than we think. So perhaps you could just talk a bit about what the 1001 Nights are and introduce them to us again.
I will try.
I know.
Yeah, it is wonderful and daunting, as you say. And it's difficult to say what the Nights are. And I feel like the more I learn about them, the less I'm able to answer that question. But what we can say is that the Nights are, I almost want to end that sentence there, the Nights are, in the sense that they really are this multiple thing, and it can be a bit misleading to talk about it as a book or as a work, because I think of it more as a kind of tradition of storytelling. It's a loose collection of stories, but it doesn't really correspond to any definitions we have about what a book is. It doesn't have an author. You know, there are no authors whose names we know. We're not sure when it began, really. The earliest text in Arabic that we have is already a translation of an earlier work from Persian, which probably itself adapted material from other cultures. So there's no original that we know. There's no author. There's no end. It doesn't really end. It's this kind of open-ended collection. We know that it came into Arabic around the 9th century, and there is a very old core of stories from that time that is held together by a frame story, which is the very well-known story of a woman called Shahrazad, who is telling stories to the man she has married, who is a kind of murderous, misogynistic king who has decided to kill every woman in his kingdom. So as never to be betrayed by a woman. And Shahrazad, who is the daughter of this king's vizier, has volunteered to marry him with a strategy to end this massacre. And the ruse involves telling stories and ending on a kind of cliffhanger every night so that the king will want to hear the rest of it the following night. So that's the sort of general organizing principle. It's the device that holds together all of the stories that she tells. But no one can really agree on how many stories there are. There has been a kind of proliferation of stories ever since the very earliest. So it has a strange status because there was a perception in Europe for a long time, and maybe even today, that it is the most famous Arabic work or the greatest Arabic work. Whereas for a long time, many Arabs didn't think of it as a great text and maybe didn't even think of it as an Arabic text. So it has this unique kind of slipperiness as an object. And I think that's why it's prompted so many artistic and literary responses. It seems to invite response and play rather than deference.
Yeah, you had this wonderful talk with Marina Warner, and now you're going to have Richard
Van Leeuwen.
Yes.
Yeah.
Where you talked about, or maybe Marina talked about, the sort of three-dimensionality of the text, how it is sort of endlessly leaping out of the page. And I did wonder, so you have this series of artworks that I think you started doing in last year in 2019. Mm-hmm. And then you have this kind of performance of The Night Spot, which seems to have been very quiet lately. And I'm very sad about that. and all these sort of performative things around your translation project, and I wondered what it is about The Nights that invites that.
Oh, it's a good question. You know, I think it reminds me of a lovely essay that Mazen Ma'arouf wrote about a year ago, I think, in Granta. Granta have this series where they get writers to talk about a book that they love or the best book of a particular year. And he wrote an essay about The Nights and said it was his favorite book of any year. and it was this lovely piece by a contemporary writer, you know, describing what the appeal is for someone who is drawn to experimentation in writing. It is a really fascinating text. I think he had a line about how it was almost automatic writing and that it's completely receptive to adventure and play, and I feel that too when I work on it, that it's this very pliable text. You know, it's always changing. There's something very modern about it, even maybe postmodern, because it disrupts a lot of received ideas about what a book is and what literature is. So rather than a work, I think of it almost as a channel or a kind of conduit for all these different imaginative traditions that it has borrowed from. you know, Indian and Greek and Hebrew and pre-Islamic influences, as well as maybe most importantly, Persian. But then also kind of on the other side, it has also massively influenced an extraordinary amount of literature, and particularly European literature. You know, the development of whole genres in Europe, I think, can be directly traced to the influence of the first translations of the Knights, the development of the fairy tale in the 18th century, and even of the novel. I mean, many 19th century and 20th century novelists explicitly described what they were doing as responses to the Knights. I think Dickens cites the Knights more than any other work of literature. Balzac and Stendhal and all these kind of novelists with these kind of epic projects saw themselves as writing the Knights for the West. So it always has invited continuation. I think maybe because it's open-ended, you could think of all these responses as attempts to write, you know, the 1002nd Knight. There's this desire to keep it going, and a sense that it has to change in order to survive and to keep going. And of course, all the translators who've worked on this text have also been part of this tradition of changing and adapting. I mean, the whole history of the Knights in French and in English has been one of adaptation, sometimes to the point of fraudulence. And there's been a huge amount of erasure and misrepresentation and adaptation to suit the tastes of particular readers. Almost all of the translators who've worked on it until recently, you know, until the 20th century, have been part of this process. So, you know, now that I'll just take that again. As a translator, now my task is to give an accurate account of this text. You know, it is not part of my brief to alter the text or to adapt it, but I do still feel this urge or this kind of interest in manipulating the text or responding to it in some creative way. And I think both the bot and the artworks have come out of that impulse to play really with it.
Right, it's sort of an overflow, I guess, so you don't manipulate the text.
Yeah.
But so then what is your role? What do you want your translation to be that other English language translations have not been?
Well, when you think about the history of the translations, I mean, the first translation, which was Antoine Galland's in the 18th century, that was really the thing that made the Knights into a global phenomenon. It was unbelievably influential. It went through dozens of editions. It was translated in turn into many, many languages in the 18th and 19th centuries, all over the world, really, from, you know, Icelandic to Tamil to Portuguese, Japanese. It really went everywhere. And that continued to be the prototype, even after there had been Arabic editions of the Knights. Galland's translation continued to be used as a kind of original. And yet Galland's translation was full of adaptation, as I said. It was really altered to suit the tastes of the French court of Louis XIV. And then the subsequent English translators also, to some degree, altered and cut the text to suit their own concerns or the concerns of their public. So Edward Lane, who was translating in the 1840s, removed all of the sex because his audience were kind of families. So he tried to make it more kind of friendly to children. Richard Burton, on the other hand, kind of added a lot of sex that wasn't there and also a lot of other things, his own kind of prejudices and his own obsessions. And yet something that those 19th century translations really tried to do was produce kind of literary artifacts. They were quite concerned with trying to render the style or trying to invent a new style for these texts. So although they're full of problems, you know, very kind of obvious problems, they are, there's something about the language that is often kind of beguiling. And then there was a sort of sharp departure from that in the late 20th century. There were two translations of the Nights recently, one in 1990 by Hussein Haddawi, who published a translation of the core stories, so the stories that appear in the earliest manuscript of the Nights, which was produced in the 15th century. And then there was a translation more recently by Malcolm Lyons, who translated from, I think, the Calcutta II manuscript, which is a more extensive collection of stories. But in both cases, you know, those translations were done by academics into relatively straightforward prose. And in both cases, they explicitly say that they are not trying to render the stylistic effects of the original. So it's really just a kind of straightforward prose account of the stories. And there hasn't really been an attempt to do both, to give a sort of accurate, careful kind of scholarly account of what is in these stories, but also to try and produce a text that sustains close reading and that is pleasurable to read and has... And thinks about style and form as much as content. So that's, I felt like there was room for a translation that tries to do, at least tries to do all of those things. Well, at least I'll tell you where I'm at now in the process. I'm due to submit the complete Nights in 2023. And what I've just finished working on now is a selection of stories from the Nights that will be out at the end of next year. So in fall 2021, Norton will publish the annotated edition of the Nights, which will have, I think, 20 translations, 20 stories.
Okay, so we'll get the a first installment next year.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay. And sorry, I just wanted to go back a little bit to when you were talking about where this translation stands in relation to previous ones and this, you know, your goal, which is to be both in some sense more faithful perhaps to the original, but also to reflect its literary qualities more. And I find this question of like the authenticity or the accuracy of the Nights complicated, right? Because obviously translators did take a lot of perhaps unwarranted liberties, but there's something about the stories that seems to almost encourage that. And I think that is what makes them so appealing. That they somehow, you know, presumably they were being changed and added to and adapted to their audience even before they were translated into European languages. I mean, presumably that was sort of the spirit in which they were often told.
It's really, when you think of the story of the Nights, it really is a story of translation all the way down. You know, as far back as you go, every version of it is represents a change from what came before. So I think you're completely right that it doesn't really make much sense to want authenticity from a translation of this text, or even completeness, you know, because it's really not clear what that would mean. I think what I would like to try and do is give an account of the way this text has been formed almost archaeologically through time. You know, I get this feeling sometimes when I look at the text that you can almost look through it at 1,000 years of history. You know, it's this work that's been built up in layers. So rather than try and flatten it out, I would like to try and give some sense of the kind of texture of it over time. And I'm not yet sure how I will do that. I mean, you know, obviously there are all these kind of chronological layers. You know, there is a core of stories that is very ancient, that's probably 9th, 10th century. There are stories that were kind of added later in the medieval period. There are stories that came into the knights in French, the so-called orphan stories, of which Aladdin is maybe the most famous, that were introduced into the knights by Galland. And for a long time, it was believed that he had just sort of made them up to kind of bulk up his translation. And now we know that he was told these stories by Hannah Diab, who was a young man from Aleppo, about whom we know a lot more now, because he wrote an extraordinary memoir of his travels through the Mediterranean and Europe, which is about to come out in Elias Mohanna's translation, I think in the next few months, which is very exciting because, you know, this person was really an absolutely central figure in the history of the knights, who was never named by Galland and never acknowledged. So it's...
Isn't he mentioned in Galland's memoirs in some way?
He's mentioned in Galland's diary.
In diary, okay.
Which he didn't intend for publication. But, you know, in publishing the stories that he was told by Hannah, he never acknowledged that he had this source. So it's fascinating to think of these stories as in some way Franco-Arab collaborations, because that really is the story of the knights in general, you know, not that they are Franco-Arab, but that they are completely made of mixture. They're collaborative things. And will go on being so, I think. They completely resist the desire for purity or for pinning the text down to one tradition or one language. I like what you said, Ursula, about I think you're almost suggesting that I should sort of give myself license to continue to adapt this text. And I did think of maybe adding one story, you know, a story from today or a story set in Istanbul or something, as a way of continuing the chain.
Oh, I love that idea.
I love that. Do you think W.W. Norton would go for that?
Well, it might be a challenge, you know, to spot it.
I think the story of the knights is so fun. Like the story of all the different translators, the stories of, you know, the ways in which they like completely, you know, twisted it to their own personality and their own tastes and their own circumstances, the deceptions, the fake versions, like it's a great, in and of itself, the story of the stories I find so interesting.
I totally agree.
And, I was just remembering what I was thinking about, when did I first read them? And I honestly can't remember, but the first time that I sort of became aware actually of, you know, a lot of the history of them and where they come from was because more than 10 years ago in Cairo, when I was a journalist there was this attempt to censor. Oh. there was a Gamal al-Khitani, the Egyptian writer, took over a like national literary publication. And one of the first things he did was put out a cheap issue of the 1001 Nights, you know, in these like, you know, publicly subsidized volumes. And he was sued by, I think, you know, Islamist connected lawyers who, you mentioned purity, who saw these as impure in a different way, like because there's, you know, sex and, you know, crimes and all sorts of, you know, elements, sort of impolite and impure and bad behavior. So they sued him over this, you know, because they considered this to be completely non-literary and actually sort of like immoral work. And in the course of writing this article about that, that's when I sort of like, you know, got some scholarly editions of them and read the introductions and read some stories, and but also for the first time got a sense of how they had traveled and how much and how many versions there were. Yeah. and all these sorts of things.
You know, there's a whole history of this in Egypt, because the first edition of the Knights in an Arab country was in was in Cairo, was in Bulaq, in fact.
Right.
I knew that. Yeah.
And that is the name that we still give, you know, to this, the first edition. And it was reprinted many times in Cairo, in Beirut, but it was often censored. So often the printed version people were reading was this kind of Bowdlerized version. And then I think in the 80s, there was the first attempt to print a kind of unexpurgated edition. And it caused a kind of scandal when people kind of realized, you know, how much sex and so on all these stories actually involve. So there's been this whole history of kind of censoring and adding and censoring and adding and revealing.
Right. And I think before that, if I'm not mistaken, you know, literati of previous centuries write about, you know, scorning it in a different way as, you know, genre literature that is not sort of proper
right.
to the interests of somebody who's a real literateur.
Right. Yeah. I mean, compared to so much Arabic literature, you know, of the classical period, it's not particularly impressive. I mean, the language is not very highly worked. But I find that interesting also, you know, that it almost has the cadence of speech. You can almost feel like you hear people kind of telling these stories behind the text. And that's another thing I was kind of interested in trying to think about, to produce a text that is, you know, a literary work, but also that might kind of have moments of speech or feel like it might be sung, or, you know, that it kind of slips into these other registers.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I've had scholars tell me to make sure you write that these were not oral stories, that were they were written stories.
Right.
But that there is that that element of, yes, they were written, but they were also
they were probably meant to be performed.
They were being told.
Right.
So I've heard a lot being made of the fact that this is the first translation of The Nights, parenthetically, into English by a woman.
Right.
And I loved what you said to Veronica in World Literature Today about how there have been many translations by women, like you mentioned Asya Jabbar's, Rashida Madani, Dunya Mikhail. Many women have taken this and adapted it into their own work. But is there anything you think to this, you as a woman, you now see that, I don't know.
I mean, it kind of depends on how you think about Shahrazad. I think, you know, there is this kind of widespread way of thinking about who Shahrazad is, you know, what she represents, which is that she is a woman who is resisting a sort of misogynistic tyranny. And that is clearly what's going on and has been a very important reading, I think, and has been important to many feminists, you know, to sort of reclaim her as a kind of feminist figure. But if you look at how she's described in the text, you know, we know very little about her as a woman. She's almost not introduced as a physical person, which is unusual because, in fact, a lot of women in The Nights are described in terms of their beauty. You know, there is this kind of moment where they're compared to the moon and so on. Shahrazad doesn't get that treatment. What we know about her is almost entirely internal. You know, we know about her personal qualities, and most importantly, we know about what she's read. She's this kind of library. So I think of her sometimes as more of a concept than a character. She's almost like this principle of creation that's not to do with self-expression, but is actually to do with channeling and recombining what you've read into new stories. And that's, I think that's the kind of aspect of it that excites me more, because that is the whole history of The Nights, you know. It is just to do with recombining previous stories in this kind of endless chain.
So you brought a text that you were going to read for this. Could you introduce it to us just a bit?
Yes. I'm just trying to find it. Hold on. Here we are. This is a short passage from one of the stories embedded in the cycle of The Porter and the Three Women of Baghdad, which I think is my favorite story in The Nights. And this is a section about a young woman who's the daughter of a king who has been put under a spell by a djinn. And she is trying to liberate herself by fighting this djinn. So it's a little guide on how to fight a djinn. The king's daughter took a knife engraved with Hebrew letters, drew with it a circle in the middle of the hall, and in it she carved names in Kufic script and talismanic charms and uttered solemn words. And soon the world was dark and seemed to close in on our heads, and we saw the djinn appear in the guise of a lion the size of a bull, and we were terrified. The girl said, "Get away, you dog." "Traitor," said the djinn, "you have broken the oath. Did we not pledge that neither of us would cross the other?" "What is a pledge?" she said, "to a creep like you." "Then take what you deserve," he said, and pounced on her with open mouth. But she was quick, and from her head she plucked a hair and waved it muttering around the air, and the hair changed to a blade which struck the lion, slicing it in half. But as the halves went flying, the head changed to a scorpion and the girl became a snake, and they were locked in battle for an age. Then scorpion became vulture, and the girl changed to an eagle, hunted it, and they were gone a while, until the ground was split and there emerged a cat, irregularly white and black, who snarled and snapped and growled. The girl became a wolf, and they fought a bitter battle in the palace. And when the cat was overcome, it gave a howl and turned into a worm and crept into a pomegranate lying by the pool. The pomegranate swelled to watermelon size, flew into the air and threw itself onto the marble floor, breaking to pieces. All the seeds were scattered and the wolf, changed to a rooster, descended on the seeds and pecked them all, except for one, which lay concealed at the pool's edge. The rooster crowed and flapped its wings and motioned with its beak as if to ask if any seeds remained, and cried so loud the palace seemed to shake. Then the rooster turned and chanced to see the seed at the pool's edge and dived. The seed rolled into the water and, changed to a fish, swam to the bottom. The rooster, now a larger fish, plunged after it, and for a long time they vanished. Then we heard shrieks which made us shake, and the djinn appeared as a flame of fire, casting fire from his mouth, and from his eyes and nostrils fire and sparks, followed by the girl changed to a blaze. They clashed until their fires enfolded them, and thick smoke filled the hall, and we were choking, fearing death by fire, and sure the end was near. And as the flames grew fiercer, we said, "There is no power and no strength except in God."
Wow. So I would love to see that. So you read it, and then there's like an animation going on in the foreground of all these changes happening.
I love that. And I love that they just become these kind of flames at the end, fighting.
Yeah.
There's something kind of hot about it.
You know, on this question of the figure of Scheherazade and the sort of gender dynamics, I guess, in the nights, I have to say every time I reread it, the like extreme male paranoia and misogyny of the opening and the sort of ridiculous like terror of female betrayal, like taken to, like, you know, put in these terms that are like so exaggerated that I find it funny every time, you know, the king scouring the earth for like, is there anyone more betrayed than me? And, you know, the woman who does manage despite all obstacles, you know, constantly to betray her lover. There's something, the degree of that
is... I also find the frame tale very funny. It's kind of like pulp. It's a pulp fiction that has literary pretensions. Well, I was just thinking about, you know, I set up this distinction between thinking of Scheherazade as a woman and thinking of her as a kind of voice or a channel, you know. But you've just made me think that there might be... something very powerful about the fact that she is this voice, because what the king has done, as you say, in the frame tale, is reduce her to a kind of object, you know, to control and to punish. And through her voice, through this kind of voice that can never be stopped, she has affirmed her existence, you know, beyond the body. She's not, she's a voice, she's a, you know, a body reduced to a voice, which is quite a powerful fantasy, I think. And then, of course, she involves her sister. You know, her sister is also present every night as she tells these stories. So she's created a chain of transmission and solidarity between women.
Yeah, interesting. I never thought of it as a, you know, it's an Isned chain, you know, of
Right. Yeah, and also when you think of all the women who've participated in transmitting these stories, you know, by telling them or by singing them, or there was this great sort of serial of the nights on Egyptian radio for a while, where Zuzu Nabil was the voice of Shahrazad. You know, there are all these women who've been kind of part of the transmission of these stories, which is why I'm always a bit uncomfortable when I'm described as, you know, the first woman, because it's really not true, or it's only true in this very kind of limited sense that ends up being a bit meaningless.
So also in this interview with Veronica, you mentioned all sorts of other things, the Mu'allaqat, Hay ibn Yaqzan, and I started to imagine you actually retranslating all of the classical canon, like maybe, you know, very in a Shahrazadian way, we lock you up and make you translate a new class. Okay, forget that. Never mind. But anyway, one project.
Interesting fantasy.
One thing you have worked on translating is the dream manual of Abd al-Ghani al-Nabulsi, who, okay, so you mentioned that he is your ancestor, which fascinated me, and then you didn't say anything more about that. Can you just explain that just briefly?
Well, I don't really know, you know, exactly how. He's talk about women being the transmitters. He's on my mother's 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 side. He's like that line. But this was a while ago. I mean, this was 17th, 18th century. In fact, a descendant of his in the late 18th century wrote a biography of him, which told all these stories about his relationships with his students and his kind of the miracles he performed. I mean, he was an extraordinary figure. He was one of the leading intellectuals of his age, but also he was a saint. He was, you know, one of the kind of important early modern saints in the Arab world, and was almost unbelievably prolific. He wrote something like 250 works on subjects from Sufism to the benefits of smoking. He was a great smoker and drinker of coffee. He lived to be 90 and smoked all the way through. He wrote about agriculture, he wrote about poetry, he wrote about Islamic law, and was a great traveler as well. So he traveled very extensively through the Muslim world, to Istanbul and Egypt and Lebanon and Palestine, as far as Libya, I think, and wrote descriptions of all these places that are kind of valuable accounts of these areas. And one of the things he wrote was this dictionary of dreams. It's a kind of it's a work of dream interpretation that is part of a tradition of sort of Islamic dream interpretation. But I find it fascinating because it also tells us a lot about real life. I think because dreams, of course, you know, tell us a lot about the anxieties and the desires about, you know, of the person, of the waking life. And, you know, there is this kind of Islamic tradition that sees dreams as vehicles of transcendental knowledge. So, you know, dreams are almost a part of prophecy, or might be understood as a continuation of prophetic teaching. There's a famous hadith which says that if you dream of to dream of the prophet is equal to seeing him physically. So that, you know, if you dream of the prophet, you are in some sense receiving direct prophetic guidance, which is an incredibly kind of radical idea when you think about it, for the dreams of ordinary people to be invested with this kind of authority. So he talks a lot about, you know, what it means to see not just the Prophet Muhammad, but all these other prophets. You know, if you see Ilyas, this is what it means. And if you see Abraham doing this, this is what's going on. But the dictionary is mostly not that. It's mostly not about religious figures. It's mostly about ordinary objects. So it's like the jug or the carrot or the horse, you know, and if you see all these things, this is what it might mean. But what I love about it is how contradictory it is. It doesn't say, you know, if you dream of the sea, it means this. As you heard in the bit that I read, which was the entry for the sea, it's there's so many competing, contradictory ways of reading it that it sort of almost makes the idea that it is a guide to interpretation redundant, or at least kind of sort of ironic or something, or kind of questions the whole exercise. And it ends up just telling us a lot about the kinds of people who might be dreaming these dreams and what they might
understand about. I thought it was so, you know, these in our sort of contemporary times, there's sort of these common dreams, right? You dream of, you have an exam, but you can't find the exam room, or you dream of losing your baby, or you dream of, you know, so there are sort of dreams that people talk about commonly having.
Right.
Being chased but being unable to move. Were there dreams that you could see that were common in this period, or a dream that we wouldn't have now?
I mean, I don't know how many people dream of, you know, Abraham or Elijah nowadays.
Right.
But that was this interesting thing, you know, that it was really part of your spiritual practice to dream. And that it was a very important source of guidance. And I sort of want to draw a connection between that and, you know, the work I've been doing with the knights, that there's this kind of almost like an unconscious running beneath the text that that you might excavate by reading the text in different ways or paying attention to aspects of it. I mean, in a way, that's what the bot does.
You know, right.
This bot that I've made, which is just to explain to people who don't know, it's a bot. It's an account on Twitter which tweets snippets from my translation of the knights. But I found that by extracting these excerpts and just kind of running, letting them run wild, you know, letting them have this kind of independent life free of their context, they acquired this different kind of status or something. They became, a couple of people told me that they began to think of them like tarot, or like
right, yes,
little kind of instructions for their day or something. I found that kind of interesting, that there are these bits of the text that, you know, if you remove them from their context, take on almost a kind of, I don't want to say spiritual, but, you know, this kind of other status.
Oh, right, like certainly prediction poetic, astrology,
right.
You know.
And certainly a poetic, a different kind of quality, which is similar, is something that you do in a lot of the art that you've created out of this edition of the Knights, where you've been taking pages, because there too often you isolate just a few lines or words out of a whole page, and it creates a new sentence or a new set of associations between words.
Yeah, that was also a way of responding to the sort of vexed history of translations of the Knights in English, which is really a history of misrepresentation. So the translation I've been working with to make these visual pieces is Edward Lane's translation. Who was a great eraser himself. I mean, he erased, you know, all of the erotic content, the poems, you know, anything that he felt was not kind of suited to his audience, he got rid of. You know, so I was aware of this kind of almost like a sort of violence he'd done to the text, or at least these kind of liberties that he'd taken. And I'm also, you know, aware of the place of the knights within a wider history of Orientalism, you know, how the knights became this kind of foundational object in the construction of the Arab world as a kind of strange other. You know, so I was aware of all these things. And at the same time, there were things in Lane's language and in his work that I still found beautiful and valuable. And that ambivalence was something that I was interested in exploring. And I found it difficult to explore in writing. You know, I am sort of committed to the kind of critique of Orientalism. And at the same time, you know, there is plenty in this work that I find interesting and sort of beautiful. And I found that visual techniques allowed me to explore that ambivalence. You know, there's something very immediate and efficient about cutting up a text. You know, it's a very kind of efficient form of critique, just painting over it. But at the same time, you know, by letting bits of the text shine through, it is also a kind of homage to the language or to the text, but it turns it into something else. So I thought of it as this kind of double gesture of both, you know, critique and dissent, but also homage to this odd predecessor.
And you talked about it as you found it at a cafe where they had books, old books, yeah, on the shelf.
Yeah.
And you just asked them, can I take this home and and break it?
I didn't ask them if I could break it. Yeah, it was this completely fortuitous thing. And I didn't, you know, I didn't set out to deface it. It's something that kind of happened gradually. It was just a sort of insomniac project to begin with. But it's led to some interesting things. You know, I think of them as these poems kind of buried in the text.
Interesting. So you also write poetry yourself?
Once in a while.
Once in a while.
You mustn't tell anyone.
But you recently won this poetry prize.
I'm afraid we're about to out about you completely.
That. Yeah, that was a big surprise. A really lovely, lovely surprise. But I'm very glad that you mentioned it, because this is my chance to thank you on air for inspiring it. Because this was a poem, the idea of it came to me when you, Marcia, asked, I think you asked Twitter whether what people, you asked for translations of the Arabic phrase Ashar Diwan al-Arab, which is this kind of ancient piece of wisdom. I don't know actually what the origin is, if it's been attributed to anyone, but it's this kind of you know, very widespread saying about the place of poetry within Arab culture. That you know, you got a lot of kind of very thoughtful and accurate responses, and I think I just replied something facetious, you know, completely misunderstanding the Arabic phrase, or thinking about how you could translate it in a way that thought about other meanings of those words, other meanings of the word shair, and other meanings of the word diwan, and that led to this idea of a poem that would be composed of alternative translations of that phrase, because it seems to me that it's a phrase that has become slightly emptied of meaning. You know, it's a phrase that insists on the importance of poetry to Arab society. And, you know, I'm not sure that is really the case anymore. I'm not sure how many contemporary poets feel themselves to be central to society. So I kind of like this idea of this bit of wisdom that's been kind of worn down and rubbed away, and of creating kind of slightly absurd alternative translations for it.
Yeah, and so your act of poetry is also an act of translation.
Right.
Yeah, well, so we, yes, so please, could you read it for us?
Conventional wisdom. Arabic saying translated 20 ways. Poetry is the record of the Arabs. The art of poetry is Arabs collected. Good poetry is a list of Arabs. To speak in verse is to remain in Arab memory. To surpass another poet is the Arab Odyssey. Knowledge is the Arab living room. Feeling is what Arabs call the office. Falsehood is the Arab court of justice. Noticing is the Arab account book. Reckoning is the Arab reckoning. Being awake is where Arabs rest their heads. Being aware is how Arabs anthologize. Plants are Arabs immortalized. Trees are the Arab board of advisors. Vegetation is the Arab Chesterfield. Saffron is, for Arabs, stray poems gathered. Fur is the Arab sofa. What grows on the body is the Arab saga. Bristles are a gathering of Arabs. Hair is the Arab archive.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.